Now, the Wild About Pets radio show, the place to learn something new about household pets and wild animals. Here's your host, educator and naturalist, Susan Frank.
Hello, welcome to the show. I have always loved elephants. Since childhood, they have been one of my all-time favorite animals. As a kid, I never liked seeing them in zoos, however. It made me feel really bad to see them in small cages all alone. As an adult, I was lucky enough to travel to my dream destination, Africa, to see elephants in the wild. Now, even though I've done a fair amount of reading about them to learn what they were really like, you could say that, as well as many others of us, I have romanticized elephants in my mind. Is there something wrong with this? Well, after reading the book Elephants on the Edge, What Animals Teach Us About Humanity by G.A. Bradshaw, that really tells the story of the aspects of their lives, culture, and intelligence that surprised me, I started thinking that this romantic notion and vision of mine, as well as the other people who feel this way, actually can blind us to be able to see them for who they really are, what their lives are like in captivity, and how we as humans are affecting them in the wild. Today, Gay Bradshaw is my guest, and she will tell you things you never knew about elephants. You will hear astounding ways in which they respond to stress, just like we do, and you will learn how wild orphaned babies are in need right now due to what is happening in their lives. Welcome, Gay. I am thrilled to have you on the show today.
Hi, Susan.
G.A. Bradshaw is the founder and executive director of the Carullo Center and also the author of Being Sanctuary, a guide to compassionate living with animal kin. Her discovery of post-traumatic stress disorder in free-living elephants established the field of trans-species science and psychology, and we're going to find out what that means today. We will be looking at some photos during the show, so if you'd like to see them while you are listening, make sure you have the player window open on TalkZone.com. You can also access the pictures on my companion website, wildaboutpets.net. So, Gay, in talking about animals, we commonly do address what is an animal, which tends to, as I realize, simply describe what it looks like, where it lives. But after reading your book, I realize that the what really doesn't address at all the inherent essential state of being of an animal. So, Gay, what have you found are some of the notable aspects of who elephants are?
Well, I think you just said it in a nutshell. Animals are a who, not a what. And that is probably something that's intuitive to everyone, but our culture conditions us to look at animals, we call it objectification, see them something as less than or definitely different than us as humans. And I would say that the research that I've been doing, which draws from neurosciences and psychology and animal behavior and other disciplines, all really come to the same conclusion, and that is that elephants and other animals are just like us.
Ooh, that's a huge statement. What, in what ways would you like to say that they are like us?
Well, we've been really used to looking at differences. And in fact, our modern human culture tends to look at the world in terms of who's similar and who's different. And really, when it comes down to it, we're finding out that there are more similarities than differences that are shared between us and other animals. And really what that means is that if you think about who we are and humans are and ourselves, we think about, well, we're emotional beings, we have culture, we have, you know, complicated ways of thinking, we have intense relationships with our family and friends, and we have a sense of self, consciousness, all of those different kinds of things which we thought was unique to humans and unique to ourselves is found among elephants and other animals. So when you look from that perspective, we're really pretty much the same.
Mm-hmm. And I especially found the way you wrote the book, where I learned about myself as a human and elephants, in a way that was quite masterful, actually, Gay, because I really wasn't setting out trying to learn about myself, but I found myself so drawn in learning more about what it means for me to have a sense of self, you know, really what are the markers of that and how that correlates to elephants. And I have a picture, it's number 5, that I particularly mm-hmm. liked that shows an elephant's eye. And you go into how we kind of determine that sense of self. So let's talk a little bit about that, which of course also will lead to some of their intelligence. So what determines, you know, if a being has a sense of self?
Well, there's a lot of formal tests that science performs to measure or to inquire whether someone has a sense of self. And one of them is called the mirror test. And what that is in fact, it was recently performed on some elephants in the Bronx Zoo.
Yes, we have a photo of one of them, Happy the elephant.
Yeah, and she was considered to be the superstar there. She really confirmed that elephants do have a sense of self by the criteria that science uses. And what that is that they've done this with other species like dolphins and orangutans and chimpanzees. And what the scientists do is they hold up a mirror and they paint a white cross or a dot on the forehead of the animal. And then they see what the animal is going to do or if she or he does something when she looks into the mirror. And in this case, Happy looked in the mirror, was very curious about it, and then touched the cross on the white cross that you can see in the photograph on her forehead. And that's considered to be an indication that they know who they are. In other words, they see themselves, they recognize themselves, and are able to indicate it as such by holding up their trunk, or if it's a chimpanzee or dolphin, moving some other part to indicate that, oh, I see myself, and oh, there's something on my forehead. And that's called the mirror self-recognition test.
What are some of the other things about their intelligence that surprised you?
Actually, nothing, to tell you the truth. But, you know, I guess what one would call surprise is, you know, again, these are just definitions that science and our society has set, and they're pretty arbitrary, and they're very human-defined. Things like being able to use a tool, that's been considered to be a very definitive characteristic of humans. And, in fact, all sorts of animals use different kinds of implements, sticks and poles and rocks, to do different things. Elephants use one of the famous kinds of things is they pick up a stick and they scratch the side of their back that they can't reach, kind of like we would with a back mm-hmm. scratcher.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there's a crow that actually they pick up a stick and they have done this in a laboratory to pick, they use a little stick and fashion it to be able to go down a narrow tube in order to pick up a piece of tasty food. So those are all kinds of things of intelligence. I think we can also talk about emotional intelligence. Lately, scientists have been talking about intelligence, not just how smart we are, like how we can do math, which is what chimpanzees have been found to do, better math than humans. and that's been, you know, demonstrated, is also how we function socially and emotionally. And elephants and other animals are incredibly sensitive emotionally and have profound emotions like grief and joy and affection and curiosity. And so from that perspective, animals and elephants in particular have, you know, very high quotas, you would say, of emotional and social intelligence.
Our phone lines are open. It is Friday, July 1st. You can call 888-463-6748 or email me at susan@wildaboutpets.net to ask Gay Bradshaw a question about elephants. I love the fact that today we more openly talk about animals having emotions. You and I clearly know that anyone who's worked with them or have lived with animals would say it's so obvious. But of course, in the scientific community, we had to be so careful not to speak about them. But I would say it seems like that's changed a lot. Would you agree with that?
Yes, it is. I think that really over the last few years, and certainly since I started publishing this work in 2000, in the early 2000s, I think that there's been much more of an acceptance that animals are the same as us or similar to us. People don't like to use the word same, mm-hmm. but definitely comparable to us in terms of their intelligence and mental and emotional capacities. What really is the resistance or the sticking point are the implications. If they're just like us that way in terms of all the things that we have coveted for ourselves, saying we're unique and given us privilege, then now it seems that animals should have those rights as well. And that is a very difficult thing for people to accept.
Yes, and of course, as reading the book and finding out a lot more about elephants' experience in their life in captivity and in the wild being affected by us, it is harder to hold on to this world view that we have, at least in this society, of these are creatures that are there for our entertainment to watch. And you go into that whole topic of, well, you know, us, you know, just seeing them as things to look at. And I have participated that obviously also when I watch the elephants used in entertainment and commercials and movies and when I've gone to the zoos. And so it becomes difficult because either do we, you know, hang on to that vision and keep that blind eye, or does that get stripped away, as it probably should and must?
Well, that's the big question. Even, for example, the, you know, you were talking about the entertainment industry where animals are used in circuses and in zoos, but it also includes research.
Mm-hmm.
So when we're looking at animals, like in the case of the Bronx Zoo, where they looked at Happy, who was doing this mirror self-recognition test, a lot of the things that we do in education and research would not be allowed for people. They're not allowed for people because they're forced against their will. But they continue to do them with animals. And so really what we're faced with is re-examining and having to address and change the foundation of what our culture is. And that is very radical. You know, the question is, the information's there, the science is there, but do we have the willpower and the commitment to carry through?
Well, this is a perfect lead-in to a term that you use in terms of the center, the Karuo Center, and also throughout the book, which is trans-species thinking or psychology. What do you mean, Gay, by trans-species, first of all?
Well, it sounds, I came up with that term to, which sounds kind of like Star Trek, but I came up with the term to really get us away from thinking in terms of animals and humans. The trans is really supposed to erase the and. We're always saying and, humans and animals, humans and elephants, et cetera. So trans species, really what it's describing is what we've been talking about over the last few minutes. It's really stopping seeing ourselves as separate from nature and other animals and understanding us that we are just one among many species. And an elephant is just, you know, a different type of human. Or a cat is a different type of human in that way. And trans-species living, which is what the Karuo Center encourages in terms of its research and education programs, is really trying to put those concepts into action, into our everyday living. How do we change our lives when we understand that our cat is not much different than a person in a cat suit? How do we do things that we can live our lives ethically, that really respects and supports the self-determination, the right of every individual to live a life in freedom and security?
And we're rather hardwired for this. I was fascinated by your discussion of what were called mirror neurons. And I think you described it's the thing that allows us to salivate if we watch somebody eat an ice cream cone, or to be able to identify or relate to animals when they're doing things that we do. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Well, essentially, that's the, you know, that's what we would call empathy, the capacity to have empathy, to feel and care for someone else other than ourselves. And that's very natural in other species. You can see that the societies like elephant society, parrot society, they're very group-oriented. They're very caring. They're very non-self-centered in that way. And so mirror neurons is just science's way of saying these are the things in the brain that make an explanation for our feelings of empathy for another.
Would you say some of that led to more of the development of the trans species psychology or idea?
It all feeds into it. There's all sorts of a huge accumulation of data and theory that come from neurosciences, psychology, and animal behavior that all converge and basically say there's one unitary model, that's a single model, a single way of looking at animal and human brains and minds and behavior and consciousness. And it's what we do to think about to understand the human behavior and human mind we can use in the same way with cats and rabbits and elephants.
I'm talking to Dr. Gay Bradshaw, author of Elephants on the Edge, What Animals Teach Us About Humanity. Our phone lines are open. It's July 1st. Call 888-463-6748 or email me at susan@wildaboutpets.net to ask Dr. Bradshaw, we're calling her Gay today, a question about who elephants are, because Gay is her first name. So let's talk more about elephants and their social life, because they have a very rich and complex social life. I like the picture also, it's number 8, showing two young African male elephants with their trunks intertwined. And to make sure we set the stage properly, Gay, let's make sure that everybody knows what the trunks are used for. Because sometimes children kind of think, oh, it's their mouth, and it's not. So let's go through that and also how they use their trunks in ways that people might not know about.
Well, the trunk, for one thing, you can see is it's like a long nose. So they breathe through it. They suck up water and put the water in their mouth, just kind of like a straw. And then they squirt it in their mouth, or they squirt it at each other, or they squirt it on their bodies. It's also, the trunk is also like a hand that reaches out to touch and to communicate with their family and other animals, and to sense things in the environment. So you can think about the trunk as just this sort of amazing thing that has all these different kinds of capacities and roles. And sniffing. We tend to just look at visual or hearing, but most of the animal kingdom uses all of their senses all of the time. And so there's communication happening on all different kinds of planes and modalities, and the trunk is a very important one.
I like the idea that they use them, obviously, to express affection, because they are very affectionate animals. Mm-hmm. Also, the family is huge in the elephant culture, and it's led by the female, a matriarch. Tell us more about what family life is like for elephants.
Well, the elephant society, the traditional elephant society, is very much like a lot of indigenous or traditional older societies in the human world. I guess you call the basic kernel or the basic element of elephant society is what we call the natal family. And that has a matriarch, who's the older female, who's the leader, and other female elephants who comprise allo mothers. Allo mothers are like aunties. So it's a group of females, of aunties and the mothers, that are taking care of the babies. And that comprises the natal family. And the babies live in the natal family until, they're about 9 or 10 years old. The females, the little girls, stay on and grow up, but the boys leave and they go to the all-male area or group. And that's what we call a second phase of socialization. So that is when the young males, they learn about how to be a bull elephant, and they learn all sorts of things. And then those groups of elephants are really nested within another set. So you can think of many, 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 many natal families and bulls, and it makes this hierarchy. So at one point, before the Europeans, the white settlers, came to Africa and killed so many elephants and wildlife, the elephants were all over Africa. And so it was this giant sort of octopus of elephant society, very intricate. And they migrate hundreds and hundreds of miles. So it's not like they live in isolated pockets. They really have a very complex communication and culture.
What happens to a family if the matriarch is killed?
It's a huge event. And Cynthia Moss, who is a researcher in Africa, has written extensively about this. It's fascinating. Echo was a very prominent matriarch, and when she died, Cynthia describes it as like an earthquake. It was a huge thing. It was emotionally a tremendous impact. And a new matriarch takes her place to lead the family. But it's important to realize that there is such deep emotions and such deep ties, and that the matriarch is really not just a leader, but very knowledgeable. She knows all of the details about the landscape, you know, where the water is found in case of drought, you know, where are the, you know, places to go where there's special grasses, all these kinds of things. So the matriarch is really someone who holds a lot of wisdom and knowledge of the culture.
I'm reminded of, even in my family, my mother was very much the center of mm-hmm. the family. And when she passed away, we all felt that center disappearing. And I'm sure there must be many other people who have had that same experience.
Mm-hmm.
And so we probably, whatever levels of grief that we have been able to feel, I would say would be felt by the elephant families.
Yes, definitely.
When we come back, we're going to talk a little bit more about what people are more commonly aware of, that elephants do tend to display signs of grief and mourning, and they revisit some of where their relatives had died. We'll get to that right when we come back. Stay with us.